Hi, this is Daniel Garb of the Movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. It's the 1960s. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Outside, the snow is falling and friends are calling Yoo-hoo. It's Christmas time in the city. Mom, Dad, and the two kids get in the car to go out for a traditional family dinner. Is it ham? Turkey? No, it's Chinese food. Because these folks are dreaming of a Jewish Christmas. Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas is a new documentary that looks at the celebration of the secular holiday in North America and how it's reflected in popular culture, especially Christmas songs. It reenacts a 1960s dinner in Chinatown with new performances of classic Christmas songs by Stephen Page, Dion Taylor, and Aviva Chernick, among others. The film was produced in Toronto by Jason Charters and Liam Romalis at Riddle Films and directed by Oscar nominee Larry Weinstein. It's playing on CBC this weekend, and I'm very pleased to have Jason here in studio and Larry by telephone to explain what exactly Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas means. Hi, Jason. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Larry. Are you safely on the side of the road out there?
I am on the side of the road with a few snowflakes falling on my head. I think I'm seeing a white Christmas.
You're seeing a white Christmas. Okay. So, Jason, I first heard the term Jewish Christmas from a secular Christian friend about 10 years ago. And he described it as going out for Chinese food and a movie on Christmas Eve. But you seem to you found a deeper historical background for this. This has occurred for a long time, or
yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I don't think I knew it was there when we started it. You know, it's like many films. I think Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, you come up with an idea and you think, wouldn't it be cool to do something about all the Christmas songs that were written by Jewish songwriters, and then you got to figure out what it is. And you know, I don't think we knew that there was such depth when we started. It just seemed like a fun idea. I grew up with the two traditions. So my mom is Jewish and my dad is Anglican. And so for the first 10 years of my life, I celebrated Christmas and tree, and well, it was a 2-foot-tall tree. I think that was the compromise in my family, was one of those tabletop trees.
Like the Charlie Brown Christmas.
Like the Charlie Brown Christmas. And then when I was about 11 years old, we started going down to Florida at Christmas time with my mom's side of the family. And so Christmas became the Chinese restaurant and a movie. So this is kind of something that's always been a part of my life. And exploring that story through the music just seemed like a really fun way to look at the Jewish take on Christmas.
Larry, the film has a nostalgic feel to it, but the nostalgia isn't for home life, home celebration of a holiday, but for going out, specifically to a mythical Chinese restaurant where the waiters wear red jackets and they sing and dance in the kitchen and the dining room. So talk about this mythical Chinese restaurant you created for the film.
Well, it's mythical and it's not, because it is sort of a distillation of all of our memories and maybe an idealization of the memories, because I mean, that mythical restaurant that we shot in is an actual restaurant in Toronto, which started in 1955 and actually has not changed its design since.
Really?
I'm not sure it's changed its menu since either.
What's it called?
It's Seahigh Restaurant on Bathurst Avenue. Huh. And it happens to be the same restaurant that is among my very first memories. It's the first restaurant I remember as a small child going to with my own family.
Oh, so this has personal meaning to you.
Yes, it does have personal meaning. And we went from that restaurant to another restaurant. We went to a series of different Chinese restaurants. All of them are gone now, sadly, that we kind of graduated to. But this original one is still there. So we kind of took its own natural architecture and enhanced it. Marion, we had the designer, enhanced it. And in my own childhood memory, I kind of imagine there being all kinds of magic with the waiters and everything. So we just kind of enhanced it. They now sing and dance, and even in the kitchen they sing Holly Jolly Christmas. And so it is mythical, I guess, in that regard. But it's the magic of a holiday that's totally associated with magic. So I think we all think it's appropriate.
Jason, one of the main themes of the movie is the prevalence of Christmas songs written by Jewish songwriters. So where did this phenomenon come from?
Right. You know, I think if you want to go to the beginning, well, I don't know. If you want to go back to the beginning, I guess you're talking about Jesus, who was Jewish.
Let's bring it up a little bit more modern.
But jumping ahead, about 1800 years, really, I think it started with the mass waves of Jewish immigration in the late 1800s. In about a 40-year time span, almost 2 million Jewish immigrants came from Europe and from Eastern Europe to North America. Over a million of them ended up in New York City. And, you know, at that time in the first half of the 20th century, these Jewish immigrants, they couldn't just, you know, apply for a job at any old business. A lot of businesses were closed to them. I mean, there was quite a lot of anti-Semitism, even though they were coming for a new start and to get away from the troubles that they had in the old world. Music was something that a lot of these immigrants and the children of immigrants had in their tradition, in their blood, if you will. You know, they grew up with instruments, playing instruments. It was a big part of their lives. And the music industry in the early part of the 20th century was open to anybody. It didn't matter whether you were Jewish or Christian, black or white. It didn't matter. If you could play, if you could write, you could be a part of it. And at that point, sheet music was taking off. A lot of mainstream business people, if you will, had no interest in sheet music because you made a penny off of every sheet. I mean, you had to sell so many of them. But Jews somehow embraced it. And so then you have the rise of Tin Pan Alley, which is dominated by Jewish publishers and songwriters. And you have people like the Gershwins and Irving Berlin. And they get into the music business. And Christmas music is just kind of logical, really. I mean, they were writing every kind of music, dance music and Eastern music, you know, all sorts of music, and Christmas music, why not? I think what they brought to it, though, these Jewish songwriters, is, again, their roots as immigrants or as children of immigrants, they had a sense of loss and of longing for what they left behind and a sense of nostalgia for the old world and the old customs, and they were in this new place, and they infused their music with this sense of nostalgia, and, of course, that has become a huge part of the way we identify Christmas. Christmas is a nostalgic holiday for everybody. It doesn't matter whether you're an immigrant or you're not, whether you've been here for generations, whether you're Christian or you're Jewish. We all kind of have that feeling of, oh, you know, the old days, my childhood, it was so perfect. You know, that is Christmas to people, and that was in the music.
Larry. So picking up on the nostalgia thing, you combined a lot of different elements. So you had the live performances, you had old stock footage, and you had lots of snapshots and Super 8 movies from people's childhood. Where did those come from? Are they yours or?
No, they weren't. Some of them were mock home movies. They were the home movies that we constructed using a Super 8 camera. And so the Jewish family that we show, that we feature going to the restaurant, we shot a lot of that like home movies. The little boy in the film is someone that I kind of identify with. Maybe he's an alter ego. He's about 10 years old. That's how old I was when I got my first camera. And then there's even a reference to him becoming a filmmaker who's obsessed with music, and I've made about 30 films about music. So
no, I noticed there's a scene where the Chinese waiters are dancing and he suddenly pulls out his Super 8 camera.
Yeah. I mean, if we were really, I think if we were more historically accurate to the year that we're imagining to be, which is 1967, that would be a regular 8 camera.
Right. Oh, so this is the 1950s it was taking place.
67.
Oh, yeah.
Because the last song that we feature chronologically is Do You Hear What I Hear, which was actually written in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that's the last one.
Well, let's talk about this song. Larry, mm-hmm. I've always thought, Do You See What I thought that was the most not secular, the most heavy-duty, capital C Christian Christmas song there was. But you talk about an unexpected origin of that song. Could you talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real prayer for peace is what that song is. And Gloria Shane Baker, right, Jason? That's her name.
Yeah.
Gloria Shane Baker with her husband, wrote that song, she grew up in Brookline, Massachusetts, and her next door neighbor when she was very young was John F. Kennedy, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And so she was in awe of him, as the nation was. But then in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis broke, and that was Kennedy's, you know, doing. And it was a horrible, horrible time where people thought the world might end, that 17 years after World War II, people were thinking nuclear war. And so she wrote this song as a plea to him and to everyone for peace. And Do You Hear What I Hear goes right back to the essential Christ story and praying for peace. It's a protest song. It's a protest song that should have inspired people to think about human values in the combination with the nostalgia that Jason is talking about. And it's a very sweet song, and it's anti-war. You just wouldn't think of that now when you hear that song. You wouldn't make that association. And she used to sing the song throughout her career and couldn't sing without crying, thinking of the heaviness of the meaning of that song. So I know that I wanted to make it as spiritual as possible. We asked Aviva Chernik, who's a brilliant singer who sings usually sings in the Ladino, the ancient Sephardic Ladino tradition, and it's an ornamented kind of ancient singing. And we asked her if she would sing that song, and it would be very spiritual. There would be a section within it that where people spontaneously stand up in the restaurant and start doing moves that are very slow and spiritual, and it's inspired by Tai Chi. And the children would pick up glasses and start to play the rims of the glasses so it would ring in an ethereal way. And that's how we treated it. It's kind of a climax of the film in a way.
Jason.
Yeah.
All of these songs were taken from a fixed period. They could be called part of the Great American Songbook, you know, movies from musicals, jazz standards, things like that. Are there only so many Christmas songs, they start and they finish and nothing new is coming?
Yeah, I mean, it probably wouldn't be fair. And, you know, I guess Mariah Carey, and there'll be a few people that might take exception to me saying nothing new came along after that. But you're right. I mean, I think what we looked at was this period of songwriting that did coincide with the Great American Songbook. And ended when that songbook ended. And really, the Christmas songs in particular really began, this period of songwriting began during the Second World War. Winter Wonderland preceded it just slightly, but really, you know, the first big one is White Christmas, and that was 1941 that it was written. Irving Berlin, yeah. And it ended in the mid-60s. And, you know, we felt, and certainly we put it forward in the film, that really there was an end of innocence that kind of came with the 60s, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, with Vietnam. In a way, people just, it was too hard to believe in Santa Claus anymore. We were not innocent enough to believe in him anymore. And the music kind of ended with that innocence. And after that, from time to time, you have these songs, but not in that same tradition.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
Because we did sort of talk about when should we set this piece? When should we? Mm-hmm. And we talked about 1967, which has a nice thing about it with Canada, which of course was our expo, and people were very wide eyed, and there was a real sweetness. But it also, now we realized 1968 was a real turning point year, because in the States, of course, it was the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And of course the riots in Columbia University and all, like, it was a real awakening, and the anti, you know, Vietnam movement was at a full tilt, and the election of Nixon in Canada, the world was a mess in 68, you know, the Russians pulling into Prague and I mean, every country had terrible things going on, except for Canada, because we had this optimism in 68 where Trudeau was elected, and there was that wave of Trudeau mania, and it was an idealism. But we decided, let's step back a little bit and set it in 67. And that wide-eyed sort of innocence and naivete, I think, was reflected in the music.
Well, it's a good note to end on. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, sure.
Larry Weinstein is the director, and Jason Charter is the producer of Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas. You can see it on CBC Documentary Channel, Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. This is Daniel Garber, the movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and my website, culturalmining.com.